Hello everyone, you're listening to The Lit Pickers. I'm here with my friend Supriya Nair, who is here with
my friend Deepanjana Pal.
We're here today to talk about a subject that we didn't realize we felt so strongly about until we actually started thinking about it, which is the idea of scandalous women authors. And initially, you know, I didn't think we had that many scandalous women authors or literary women, let's put it that way, because authors implies prose, and that's not what I mean. But the more we thought about it, or at least the more I thought about it, I realized that the moment a woman actually sits down to write, she scandalized somebody. Just that seems to be the starting point.
My jump-off point, once we started talking about this, was a piece of writing that I think about much more than I actually should. And I discovered this a few years ago. It was a review essay written in 1993 by then non-discredited writer and editor Tarun Tejpal, who was tasked with explaining why Shobha De, by then an eminent columnist, magazine editor, and novelist, had sold staggering numbers of copies of her first three or four books. And this piece is such a work of condescension. You can feel the critics' ridiculous jealousy, you know, kind of dripping sleazily from every word. And I will give you a taste of this so that you know what I'm talking about.
Just as you start, I'm going to take a deep breath so that I don't explode and my brain doesn't spatter across the studio. Please, please continue.
Let me read to you from the opening of this essay. If some advertising wisecracker with a crimped ponytail and jeans open at the knees were to reduce her to a slogan, he'd probably decorate her before a mahogany and leather bookcase and declaim, "Her looks sell her books." Like even the worst quick sell slogans, Tarun Tejpal continues, this would contain a partial truth. If there were an odometer to measure what would travel further, her books or her looks, human craft would genuflect to nature's recipe. For while she's very good-looking with attractive almond eyes, cascading hair, and an exquisite bone structure, her books are thin gruel on the palate, the taste forgotten even as it slaloms over the taste buds.
I have actually thrown up in my mouth while listening to this.
Was it like thin gruel on your palate?
It was like his ponytail of
crimped.
The past. Yeah. What is that?
And it goes on essentially to say, oh, here is an obviously smart, successful woman who's done very well for herself, who has, of course, married up in life, you know, because God forbid a woman do that, and has produced, you know, extraordinarily produced like four books in 4 years or whatever she's done. Shobha De, famously productive, efficient, never forgotten the fact that she once said she sits down and writes 1,000 words a day, every day.
Amazing.
And basically spins this essay on the idea that in spite of the fact that this woman has everything, she doesn't have the one thing she wants, which is critical success. because I suppose men like Tarun Tejpal wouldn't give it to her. I'm not here to defend Shobha De's writing if you dislike it. Right? I mean, I think everybody can agree. Look, the greatest novelists in the world have people who hate their work.
Yes.
And Shobha De is certainly no different. But knowing that something like this could be produced in 1993 gave me a sense of what it meant to succeed in India until very recently, and perhaps even today.
I think it applies even today, one.
You're right.
I mean, I don't think this masquerading thing that you just read out, because it's truly not a review, but I don't think this would necessarily be carried today unless it was being done for the clickbait, which I can see happening. But just as a tangent, I really don't think critics realize how much of themselves they reveal in their writing, you know?
This definitely gave me a sense of exactly who this person was.
Yeah.
In a way that was perhaps unintended.
You think that you're being objective. Every critic prides themselves, most of the time at least, on being objective. But there is no such thing as objective and dispassionate in the way, you know, most people understand that
right.
term.
And you and I, for example, don't even pretend to
no,
do that.
No, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, if anything, I think it is irresponsible to pretend you're objective because your subjectivity has everything to do with how you see a work, which is patently obvious in this review, for example, you know. But also this idea that a woman or certain kinds of fiction to begin with need critical acclaim, or that anything needs critical approval, is very central to the high horse that people occupy, certain people occupy, and certainly the elite establishment, the masculine elite establishment. That's something that has carried on till the present. And it's the sort of thing that, you know, popular fiction writers, best-selling authors like, pick your favorite, anyone, Ravinder Singh, Durjoy Dutta, Amish, Chetan Bhagat, whoever is your favorite author, because these men tend to occupy these
positions.
Sorry
to the ones who are my friends.
They will constantly complain about how they are not receiving critical acknowledgement. Sometimes they will not complain as much as just observe that they're not being given this approval. Mm. Because to be given that approval means a certain kind of acknowledgement, which they would like.
That's true.
And there's nothing wrong with wanting that acknowledgement.
But it's so typical, right, that men like this complain about this stuff as if they're the first people in the world or the first people in India to go through it.
When in fact, women have been facing this for as long as anyone can remember or forget, as the case may be. Because while you were reading this, I was thinking back to the Bhakti period poets. Someone like, for example, Andal, who is 7th, 8th century approximately, the only female saint among the Alvars, but that's a later acceptance. Her story begins with a certain kind of being kicked out, because she wrote sensual, sexual poetry addressing a divine figure, basically Ranganatha, who is an embodiment, an avatar of Vishnu, or a vision of Vishnu, as it were. So she writes all of this practically erotic poetry. It pushes her out. There is a male establishment that turns around and says that she's absolutely wrong. The god seems to intervene, and so they are forced to accept her. The only way that she is ultimately accepted is by seeing her as a consort to the god, right? So it's not for her letters. The letters that are attributed to her that she's written are scandalizing. All of these men, these basically middle-aged upper caste men who are like, we cannot see God this way. Like
clutching their sacred threads.
She's clutching her bosom and they're clutching their sacred threads.
That's true.
It's kind of tragic.
Yeah. But, and while the connection between Andar or Meera and Shobha Day may not be immediately evident, one of the things that I think is that it becomes okay to mock them and push them to the margins because they are writing about the body or because they're writing about sex in ways that men are jealous of and want control over.
And it's also interesting to me, particularly with Andal, that the way she ultimately is accepted is actually as sort of an epitome of chastity, because she will not marry anybody else. That she will only have Ranganatha as her lover.
Got to be the bride of God.
Exactly. Mm. And that's where it's kind of interesting to look at somebody who comes a little bit later, Mahadevi Akka, who's a Kannada poet. And she was writing in the Vachana form, which is prose. So kind of between prose and poetry, I guess, would be the spoken word in the modern sense, really. but Mahadevi Akka is interesting because unlike Andal, who... One of the reasons why she gets acceptance is, A, she becomes the consort, right? But also her father backs her. Her father is supporting her when she says, I will not get married, or I see this god as my lover. Mahadevi Akka, on the other hand, is forced to marry a king. We get references to her rejecting social custom, so she goes around naked, which is literally rejecting all social norms. She is ultimately later accepted, but for the duration of her life, the things that she says, the way that she presents herself, they're all sort of scandalized once again. And when I was thinking of this again, like you said, it may not seem like, you know, erotic religious poetry. What does that have to do with the sexy fiction in the 20th and 21st century? A lot, actually. Because just think about it for a second.
Decouple it from the deathlessness of the literature, as it were.
Yeah. And also think about what is it that is considered scandalous? Because there are multiple things happening here, right? One of the things is obviously a woman talking about sex. Why is that so scary?
It's because a man has never written about giving a woman a good orgasm in literature.
I mean, I think he's written about it. Has he actually done it? It's another matter. But just, you know, standard statistic. 80% of lesbian women say that they have orgasmed during sexual activity. 20% of heterosexual women can claim the same.
That was very neat. That was a very neat split. It's.
I think it's actually 25. But yeah, there you go. It is quite neat. But coming back to sex and women and writers, part of it is, of course, women articulating their desires. Also, these writers put women in central positions, right? This is not to say necessarily that this is progressive. It isn't always. There's often the power dynamic, for instance, in all of these bhakti poetry, the poet slash devotee is very much saying that they are the weaker one in many ways, right?
I'm like, into that.
Submissive one. And we all know that works. So it's not a simplistic power dynamic in the slightest, but it is centering the woman, much like, you know, most women authors have done with their works. And I think that's one of the things that makes society uncomfortable.
How dare you have control over your body and how it's perceived and what sensations you derive from it? I suppose this is weird because it genuinely sounds right, like to, and it may sound to many people listening to us, if there are many people listening to us, that this is an argument that got like left behind in the 1960s after we like resolved all our problems with feminism. But I do think that the kind of woman that attracts controversy when writing and publishing, even today, says a lot about how much we have left unresolved in our culture, in our writing, and in how we react to it as readers. It's not like modern Indian history is devoid of women who have shocked and appalled the public either because of something they have written, or let me put it this way, almost always because of something they have written, but in a way that then allows the public to focus on their private lives. Shobha Day, classic example of how this works. Amrita Pritam.
Absolutely. I was just thinking of Amrita Pritam because, you know, I mean, as a poet and a writer, there's a certain kind of feminine experience of partition, of nationality, of identity that she sort of foregrounded in her work. Emotional feelings were foregrounded in her writing in a way that was considered very clearly feminine and therefore not literary, you know, sentimental in that sense. And yet, of course, it wasn't sentimental in a negative sense. It's Amrita Pritam's writing is a fabulous example of good sentimental poetry. And yet, I think what most people know of Amrita Pritam is her unrequited love for Sahir Ludhianvi. I think what really scandalized people, particularly in her time, was the fact that she pursued Sahir Ludhianvi, right? She was married, unhappily married at the time, but she pursued this other man despite being married and then divorced Pritam Singh and said that, you know, to Sahir that, all right, shall we? And Sahir was like, no, I'm kind of scared. I presume that's how he talked, naturally. Translate to Urdu. Anyway, point is that Sahir Ludhianvi was not ready to commit to Amrita Pritam. So this image of the woman as the pursuer is something that nobody could shake off. And the fact that she also then went on to have this very modern relationship with Imroz. They lived together till the end of her life. They were very much in love. Mm. And she herself said that it's a different kind of love. And that, again, was like, what do you mean? What do you mean there are two kinds of love? One woman can love two men? Oh my God.
In different ways.
This is a complexity of the personal life that completely dominated how she was seen, I think.
I'm wondering now if a woman is scandalous because she writes about intimacy, love, and sex rather than for other reasons. Because some of the other examples I'm thinking of also really kind of come down to this. Who are you and how dare you? Kamala Das, you know, it's an absolute scandal in the dominant caste community that she came from. again, for writing about sex, desire, love, the body, and of course everything that went on in her personal life, including her turning away not only from her, you know, domestic bliss, as it were, but from culture, religion, and adopting
a completely new identity.
A completely new identity. You spoke about Partition, which did produce its own set of controversial women writers, foremost among which
Ismet Chughtai.
Yeah. Who's also, I mean, this is a woman who was literally dragged to court for obscenity.
Yes.
In her case, I suppose you can say that it's not necessarily unique. I mean, you know, clearly what everybody remembers about Chughtai is that she was dragged to court with Manto.
And I think what she was also later...
But the women in Chughtai stories had a better time.
Hell yeah. I mean, she was taken to court for Lehaf, which I guess most people will have heard of at least. But what's also interesting is that I remember reading a translation of her autobiography, and she felt quite constrained by the notoriety that the obscenity case brought her. Because she didn't want to be known as just the woman who writes about lesbian narratives. She was doing a lot of things with her writing that were not simply about the sexual practices, spoken, unspoken. There's also, like, simply in terms of language. And that's something that we don't get a sense of in the English translations, naturally. But she was using, for her women characters, they were speaking in what's called the women's Urdu. It's language, and I guess like a dialect that is spoken by women when they're together. So it's like their own little code. And it's not ladylike, as, you know, somebody had said it. Like, it's earthy. It's coarse often. Like, it's basically a freer sense, like not constrained by what is considered ladylike and what is considered graceful. And she brought that into literature.
So how dare she?
So, like, these were other nuances that kind of got sidelined, you know, in terms of how they were perceived. And for me, like, that's something that I think continues to happen today. Women authors particularly tend to get notoriety for a certain reason. And it makes you stop seeing, or rather it makes the public forget the literature that has merited the good attention, you know. And I'm thinking of someone like K.R. Meera, who has some extraordinary novels to her name and is the butt of insane vitriol online.
Right. Because the Malayali internet, famously feminist. Not. Although, of course, this is not to...
I mean, they're not alone in this.
That's true. Although, of course, this is not to erase what Malayali feminists do every day, every hour on the internet in resisting this overwhelming flood of sexism and misogyny. I suppose something that we have done also kind of defines the form of attention we are now talking about. Because for women, scandal is always about something that comes down to the intimate details of their lives and their thinking, regardless of whether or not this is actually what they're writing about in their novels. So, you know, even if you haven't written about sex, if you've written something that makes someone mad, they will find a way to make it about sex.
Right.
Which then brings me to a question that I have for you late in the episode, which is, not all women who write about sex tend to attract negative attention. I mean, almost none attract good attention without the negative attention. But there are some who, you know, perhaps most recently there's been like a raft of novels by young women writers whom I love and support and so will not name, that include, you know, sort of thoughts and descriptions of awkward sexual encounters, of dissatisfaction and longing and dysfunction, but whose work doesn't seem to have merited the same kind of attention.
I think the fact that they're dysfunctional has a lot to do with it. Oh. Sexuality is always much more acceptable when the subject is dysfunctional.
We come back to the point of, has a man ever given a woman a good orgasm?
Thank you.
In literature?
Yeah, that 80-25 thing I was talking about. But yeah, I think the dysfunctional part has a lot to do with it. Also, let's be fair, especially with the death of the reviewing community in mainstream culture, by which I mean there's just no space for it for reasons that I can't entirely understand and
reviewers
we can't
who,
get
the,
into.
The three reviewers who continue in mainstream media, we love and support you
yeah,
too.
Yeah, fight the good fight, yo. But anyway, the death of the reviewing culture to a large extent and the absence of things like book clubs and the limited conversation spaces that exist for books has meant that none of the people that we're talking about, these you know, more recent writers, women who are writing about bodies and sexuality, have actually achieved fame. They are not famous by any means, right? They're not household names. They're not even like Shobha De. Even if you hadn't read a book of hers, you knew of her.
You absolutely did.
Right? And one of the reasons you knew of her was because she was as productive as she was as a professional. You know, she had her columns. She was showing up at social places. She was vocal about things that she cared about. She continues to write all of these things. But I'm saying that when she initially became famous,
she really parlayed her celebrity
into... Yes, and I'm not saying that there was no role played by the fact that she did belong to an elite family, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. I'm sure that played a part. Like, for instance...
And that she had almond eyes and what an exquisite bone structure.
Look, Shobha De was stunning.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Continues to be. You know,
she's still beautiful.
Yeah. You know, I interviewed her once a few years ago, and then and we were at Kitab Khana, and of course the thorough professional at the interview. I, you know, completely loved chatting with her, and then the photographer was like, "Ma'am, let's step outside. There's still light. Mm-hmm. I'll take a few photos of you." And I kid you not, we went out to that, you know, the little roundabout outside Central Bank. And it was maybe about like 4 or 5 in the evening. And genuinely, when Shobha De strikes a pose, there's like an invisible wind machine that kind of runs through her hair. The sun kind of turns its focus so that it's like shining on her face. And suddenly you have like an oil painting.
Yeah. She's extraordinarily beautiful. And of course that helps. I mean, who doesn't want to see a beautiful face? But that said, that doesn't take away from all the work that she's put in. Like, if she had just been beautiful, that wouldn't have been enough for her to get the fame that she did. And I don't think the writers that we're talking about are, you know, we're obliquely referring to, as I said, they are not that famous. One, I think the last person who has actually, among women authors from India, who has truly achieved notoriety has to be Arundhati Roy.
That's true. Arundhati Roy shares in common with Shobha De the fact that she is a household name, even in households that don't read. This is a woman whose scandal, quote unquote, has broken away from sexuality and like this uncomfortable intimacy. And yet, remember that when the first time she was dragged to court was not because of, you know, her anti-national opinions, but because of the sex scene at the end of The God of Small Things.
It's quite interesting because I think Arundhati Roy's career as a scandal maker truly covers the entire spectrum. She started off in the obscenity court. You know, because like you said, there's one paragraph.
I mean, it's a pretty
beautiful paragraph. I remember sort of
brutal.
Fanning myself a little bit while reading it as a child because I was like,
should I be reading this?
Yeah,
for sure. It's still pretty shocking.
Yeah. So well done. But it offended an advocate whose name I've forgotten enough to file an obscenity charge against Arundhati Roy. And I think she's still fighting that case. Yeah. I don't know if it's actually been resolved.
Yeah. Sorry, I should say it's not exactly at the end of the book, which is when you have like a truly, I mean, which is when
the
you
sex
have,
scene.
So there are two, right?
There was a reference to that as well. Mm. Which was something that I found quite interesting, that incest is less scandalous than intercaste sex. Bizarre, but anyway.
And yet completely understandable.
Makes sense.
I almost want to continue to read the review I began this episode with.
Before we go back to that, I do think like it's worth keeping in mind, while the obscenity case filed back in the 90s did give Arundhati Roy a certain amount of... eyeballs. What really got her fame in that sense, she was found guilty of criminal contempt and sentenced to symbolic imprisonment.
For one day.
Because of the protests that she had been taking part in. And this was about the Sardar Sarovar Dam at that point. And her writing was deemed anti-national. And that's what I mean when I say that, you know, she's sort of covered the spectrum. Like, she's gone from being the problem child as far as, you know, writing about sex twins is concerned.
Yeah. Is concerned, yes.
And then becoming this sort of anti-mother figure, as it were, you know, like there's the Bharat Mata painting, which is your idealized national identity. And then you have Arundhati Roy. You know?
Arundhati Roy smoking a cigarette, sitting in a halter top in the Supreme Court. Yeah, in which Annie gives it those ones to apex court of the land. With that, we bring this episode to a close.
Oh, God bless all these scandalous women, man, for giving us things to read and fight for.
Thank you very much to our writers and to our listeners.
We'll see you again soon. Well, actually, you'll hear from us soon. We may not see you, but yes.
Until then,
bye-bye.
The Lit Pickers is a Made in India production. Don't forget to rate and review and follow or subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. Also, tell everyone you know about the show. Share it on social media, tell your friends and family, scream about it on your rooftop. It really helps get the word out. Oh, and use the hashtag LitPickers. Follow Supriyanth Panjana on Twitter or Instagram. You can also find all of the books they've mentioned or recommended in an online resource via a link in our episode description. Thanks, and keep listening.